Visible is a wireless carrier that is not invisible. It is pretty clear from the name. Actually, radio waves are invisible. And I can say this with authority as a licensed amateur radio operator. That being said, Visible won't be giving you the power to see light outside the visible spectrum. It's actually way better because having that ability would make getting around very difficult and distracting. What you do get with Visible is unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. You get one line of wireless, just $25 a month, which is great in these times of economic uncertainty. That is one line for $25, taxes and fees included. So whatever you're doing at this moment, please stop. Switch immediately. Now, monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com. Wir gerne sehen, was ist los? It's deinen Freund Seth. I'm learning German. Yeah, in case you didn't know what that was. That is me trying to impress you with the little German that I know. Right now, I am actually learning German. I took it in high school. I goofed off the entire time. I did some other language learning apps. They taught me things like where the taxi stand is and how to find a bus, but not a lot of conversational German. Thankfully, that's what Babbel is all about. Babbel teaches you language conversationally, which, let's face it, that is what you want to know anyway. I don't know. When I was in school, you learned like how to count. You learned like the colors. You learned the shapes. Those are all important things, but they don't help you when you're in like Cologne, Germany with Ein Nierenstein, which, by the way, is German for kidney stone, an experience I can unfortunately speak personally to. But I've been using Babbel to learn to speak German again, better than I have before. I actually really like it because it is conversational. It's a little bit more relaxed. One of the things that it does that I really like is it'll sometimes show you what the literal English translation is. And I don't know why, but I find that very helpful in sort of understanding the structure, the grammar of a language and sort of putting myself into that mind space. Since I'm only in Germany for Gamescom, which is like a week, week and a half, I'm not immersed in the German language. I'm not immersed in German culture. So what I do is the second best thing. I'm taking Babbel. Hopefully this year when I go to Germany, I'll be able to impress all the Germans with how much German I know from learning through Babbel. The app has pronunciation recognition, so you'll be able to learn how to speak better with your accent, how to actually properly pronounce the words. That way you won't get made fun of by a group of older German men because you said apple strudel and not Apfelstrudel. No, it's really cool. I'm going to say right now there is a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now you can get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, because you guys are the best ones, by the way, at babbel.com/realm. Get 60% off at babbel.com/realm. That is spelled babbel.com/realm. Rules and restrictions may apply. Hey there, Super Ninfriendos. Guess what it is? It's episode 619 of Nintendo Voice Chat. I am your host, Seth Macy, joined here today by Per Schneider.
Schwa.
Back again, Rep Valentine.
I feel like I'm being mocked. I just got here and I'm being mocked by one Per Schneider.
No. I was going schwa. That's an expression of happiness.
Oh. Schwa.
Yeah.
And of course, industry legend and superhero by night, Cat Bailey.
Hey, it's me. I'm in the cat cave where all the cat cakes are stored.
It's very exciting. It's a very exciting week. We have a lot to talk about. But just this morning, there was some breaking news. E3 is back. Yes. I mean, it's 11 months away, but it's coming back. And it's actually going to be put on by ReedPop. And if you're not familiar with ReedPop, they are responsible for such events as PAX, both East and West, Star Wars Celebration. I don't know if you've ever heard of that little sci-fi lark that people are kind of excited about. But yeah, E3 will be the second week of June 2023. And I'm curious as to the panel's thoughts on, with ReedPop sort of taking this over, does this mean it's going to be the fan event that we've all been saying for 5 years it should be?
Wait, you think it should be a fan event?
I do. I've always thought it should lean heavily into fans.
We're way more selfish than Seth.
So a giant PAX, in other words.
I'm thinking it should be a giant, more I shouldn't say PAX is very celebratory, but you know, with the big names and the big reveals and everyone there at PAX. That's what I think it should be. But I'm
And obviously the real model, I think, is Gamescom, because Gamescom is a mini E3 for Europe. It doesn't usually have the kind of the kind of announcements that you would get at E3. In some years, there's some big stuff announced, but it is this interesting event that has a business center that is basically the size of, you know, E3. And then it has this huge public space, too, for over 300,000 people who get to then play games and stuff. And they're different games in display. Like, not everything that's shown in the business center is actually on the show floor. I think that's the model ultimately to aim for. But so far, it sounds like they still want to keep it very industry focused, right? We'll see as we get closer. In recent years, E3 has opened up a little bit more. I say recent before the pandemic shutdown and the digital event. But like E3 has let in like 10,000 fans. And that has actually created some challenges, because unlike Gamescom, where, you know, the paths between the booths are like Autobahn sized, right? Like at E3, the corridors were still very narrow and they weren't really set up for the masses, and there were long waits and, you know, complications. It was really difficult to get to some places. So maybe it'll be a little bit bigger, but I don't think it'll suddenly be Gamescom or PAX.
Okay.
No. So I worked at GamesIndustry.biz, which is part of ReadPop, and Chris Dring, he used to be their publisher. Now he has an even bigger fancy title. So I guess this is my disclaimer. Like, I used to work with these people, but like a bunch of people that I used to work with and who ran business events helped run business events for ReadPop that were tied to sort of their media stuff. I know a lot of the people who are now helping be in charge of what this vision is. And to be quite honest, I'm very optimistic now knowing that they're involved, because like I was in rooms with them for a couple of years and we had many conversations about, wow, these are the problems that we see as outsiders with E3, and these are the things we wish it would be. And I do not think ReadPop is going to plan to make this a full-blown fan event and kick industry business stuff to the side. And the reason why I don't think that is because it would cannibalize PAX. Like, they don't need, they don't want to make an even gianter PAX. That would make no sense, because they already have West.
PAX all encompassing.
Right. They don't need that. And
PAX Omni.
The value of E3, I mean, it does have value as a fan event, I think. And I don't think we're going to take a step back and remove that element. But I do think there is a recognition from the people who are helping make the decisions behind this that it has lost a little bit of the benefit for a lot of the stakeholders, and not just the media, like for the actual companies showing up. So Chris Dring wrote this really interesting editorial on GI Biz that I recommend people go check out, where he basically sort of candidly talks about what it's like to be someone who has been a fan of E3 for so long and who has, you know, covered it as a journalist and is now faced with sort of this challenge of helping define what it's going to be in the future. And he talks about working with like Jeff Keighley through Summer Games Fest. He talks about the different possibilities of how they're going to assemble this going forward. And I think announcing it early was the right call, because I think that inspires confidence that there actually is a plan. There is someone steering the ship. And I think part of the problem the last few years is that no one's had any idea what's going on, and so everyone's been afraid to commit. And I think the biggest challenge they have ahead of them is getting actual big companies on board to show up and bring things that are worth seeing and talking about again. And I think announcing it early and having a clear plan and having actual incentive for industry business folks to show up is one of the best things they could possibly do to make this a good event for everyone. So I don't know what their strategy is. They have, like, I mean, we're not having secret conversations where I have been told what this is, obviously, but that
you can tell us off air.
Based on my experience, you know, working with them on much smaller events, that's what I think and hope they will prioritize. And so this news has me much more optimistic.
Yeah, I agree with you, Reb. I think the key will be getting some of the big players back on board, because as we saw with E3 in the past few years, Sony kind of dropped out and Many of the other places were scaling back. The show floor was getting sadder and sadder. And it seemed like behind the scenes, CESA was having some struggles making E3, figuring out what they wanted from E3. It's like, is it a public fan-facing event? Is it more of a journalist event? Xbox kind of took it over. And then, of course, the pandemic hit. So I think job one for ReadPop, which, by the way, I also used to work for ReadPop over at US Gamer, is figuring out what the identity of E3 is. What is it going to be? And I think ideally it is just the big summer showcase. This is the time for the games industry to shine for all of the mainstream outlets across the world. And it's funny, I see a lot of journalists saying, E3, we don't really need E3. Why do we care about E3? We have Nintendo Directs now. But I don't know of any event like E3 that really just draws the attention of the world to the games industry. Yeah. It's a spotlight.
I have one.
So bad.
I see E3 in line with the Olympics. You can have sporting events throughout the year and people will tune in. And if you're a fan of, you know, athletics or, you know, long jump or whatever, you can watch competitions being held. But there's something very different about the Olympics and how it brings people together and puts a spotlight on things. And it also serves as a discovery for new stuff. And the way E3 always functioned in the past is that you didn't just tune in to see Nintendo. Even if you were a Nintendo fan and you didn't own a PlayStation, you might actually watch the PlayStation event, or you would watch the Ubisoft event or the Capcom event. And this sort of this celebration where everything was condensed in a couple of days, and then you got also the sort of validation and the interpretations from, you know, journalists and YouTubers and like what they thought of the games that they saw, or, you know, if they played the games, what the games felt like and whether they were heading in the right direction. That was incredibly exciting and invaluable. As a consumer, I've seen E3 programming before I participated in it, because even though I'm 400 years old, there was that. And I always loved that excitement. And I think the challenge now is that, yes, a company like Nintendo or PlayStation or Xbox, or, you know, in the past Activision, felt like they had little to gain by being part of this continuous programming and this sort of industry event, and that they could just do it themselves. And frankly, they could probably do it cheaper, right? Mm-hmm. And Nintendo started a thing where when they said, well, we'll no longer do a live event, and it removed, you know, it removed something. It removed for them, it removed the failures. Remember them when the Wii remotes weren't connecting and the presentations weren't great, or when Microsoft tried to go bam and the Kinect legs were turning backwards and everybody made fun of it, right? It removed some of that by making more canned events rather than getting on a stage and doing these live performances. But it also removed a human element and some excitement, I think. And so now we're at a point where there are companies like Ubisoft. We know the leader of Ubisoft, Laurent Detoc, is really loves E3 and that sort of togetherness. And there's some companies where their leaders are less interested in it. And sometimes it just takes one person in a high position at a major studio to make a difference. But we'll see. I have a hard time believing that at this point, you know, Sony would be motivated to jump back into the fray, or Nintendo even, with a traditional stage presentation, because they're so powerful and they're so successful. But, you know, if Microsoft goes in and shows its games and Activision's and Bethesda's, there might be some pressure on them to join again. It's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you, Per. But at the same time, like, even though Nintendo wasn't directly, technically part of E3, it also still felt like part of E3 because they always had a big booth, and like a very major booth, and they would be showing off a lot of demos. There would be a lot of interviews coming out of it. And not only that, they would have a Nintendo Direct the week of the E3. Yeah. And so we wouldn't have to constantly be on Nintendo Direct watch. So I'm kind of hopeful that Nintendo will maybe embrace the new E3 a little bit, even if they're not on stage.
Yeah, and they did. Obviously, what I'm saying Nintendo started is this sort of kind of like showing other companies, so wait, you don't have to rent this giant auditorium, get on stage and do a live show, a complicated live show. Nintendo showed everybody, you can pre-record something and people tune in and love it. And of course, they were still part of the entire show and had their booths for playtime and all of that. Whereas, like, I think Activision bowed out pretty early on, right, and wasn't on the show floor anymore. And then it just kind of accelerated.
Yeah. I'll also add from a media perspective, I don't know how much we've gotten to talk about this before, but Kat and I went to Keeley's Play Days this year, which was a media only event for 2 days where we basically had a smaller venue with a bunch of demo kiosks, and it was all appointment based. Like, we made our appointments in advance and there was time and space to see everything. And honestly, that was great. And Chris Dring in his piece talked about, you know, talking to Keeley and finding some way to partner with him. This is just sort of pipe dreamy stuff. But you know what I would love? I would love if they partnered with him and let him do the media stuff. Like, if they did the press conferences and then they had a separate satellite event for media to see the closed door stuff where everything is like appointment based, separate from the mass of people standing in line and very convenient, lots of spaces for interviews, the way that event was, only slightly bigger, that would be amazing. I would love to see them do that. And I feel like that's an extremely sensible partnership given that he used to do Judges Week.
Yeah, I was going to say, isn't that what we had, right? Jeff used to do Judges Week before E3. But then, yeah, there was still the show floor and it was industry only.
It's kind of the same. I mean, I think the point of Judges Week was sort of to assign awards. I never went, so I don't know. But the Play Days was a little more come do coverage, come do news, come get interviews. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was still very small. There wasn't a ton there. But I feel like sort of expanding that and making that work. I think that would make the media person in me happy because I'd be able to do my job. And I also think that would open up, you know, I don't know. I think I feel like it would make things more convenient for a lot more people as well.
Yeah, personally, I think the model is Gamescom. That, you know, if you haven't been, it's just an incredibly well-run event that, you know, the thing to remember about Gamescom is that it's held in a city that's fairly small. It's 1 million people living in Cologne, and then the city grows by a quarter of that, right? And somehow they accommodate all these people, and they, you know, they have you know, teenagers all camping out at the riverside, and it's a big party and barbecues everywhere. It's really impressive because it becomes this cultural event surrounding that convention center, and then somehow they manage these masses. You've all seen the footage of like when the Gamescom doors open and it's like, you know, the parting of the seas. It's like this flood of people rushing in. It looks really scary, but what you don't usually see is how engineered the show floor is to handle all those people. That's not to say that you don't wait in line for ages either. That happens. But then there's this separate concourse that's all focused on media and business and its meeting rooms and all of that. It's just really impressive to see.
Hi, I'm Alexis Ohanian. You may know me as one of the co-founders of Reddit, but more recently, a large part of my identity is being a father to my wonderful daughters. In my podcast, Business Dad, I hope to open the conversation about working parents a bit. You'll get to hear from a wide range of business dads, from Rain Wilson and Guy Raz to Todd Carmichael and Shane Battier, to find out how they balance being a dad with a successful career. Business Dad is available now, so be sure to listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
So you're telling
me I think Tokyo Game Show is also maybe a model, because mm-hmm. the way they would do it is they would have two media days where you could get everything in, and then they would open the doors for audience or for crowds to come in and try all the demos on the show floor on days 3 and 4. And so I think it was kind of a good split, good compromise, I think.
I also want to be sort of clear to people listening that, I mean, well, selfishly, I want the media stuff to be done well because that's important mm-hmm. to me. But that media and also because deals are being done at E3. Business executives are meeting behind closed doors to show games and get publishing agreements. Like, that's the other thing that is theoretically happening at E3 and Gamescom and these other conferences. You want that to go well. You want people to have space and feel like they can conduct that business and feel incentivized to show up and do that business, because that's how you get more cool games on the show floor. Because if I'm a publisher and I feel like if I don't show up to E3, I'm going to miss out on a bunch of good business deals and opportunities to get the games that I've already announced in front of the press, who are all going to be collected in one space during that week. If I already feel incentivized to do that, then why not bring some demos and show them to the public too, since I'm already there and I'm already bought in. So having that element go well is very critical to having the rest of it go well.
There was also always a very palpable sense of industry coherence, that just this togetherness, that, you know, this was the entire games industry showing up. You know, obviously games media was there on top of it and some retailers, but it was the core games industry. And you could see indie developers just soaking it up and being so happy to be exposed to, you know, this creativity on display everywhere, but also being in a position to maybe have access to people to make publishing deals and show companies that would be otherwise really hard to meet with, to show them their wares. And then I always loved, you know, like you'd see Mr. Miyamoto taking a tour of the PlayStation booth, you know, like hooked up by the Sony PlayStation team, and vice versa. You would see, you know, high-ranking people from Microsoft and PlayStation, like, showing up and looking at each other's games. And there was this really kind of putting competition aside and just kind of reverence for each other's creations that there hasn't really been a replacement for that. And, yeah, you know, seeing that on display was always really impressive to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess this is all to say that I am an E3 fan, and it sounds like other people here are too. It's there's an energy to it that is really difficult to replicate, and I was definitely missing it over the past 3 years at this point. Last time I was in the LA Convention Center.
And there's always, on social media, you'll see in response to stories about E3, you always see people's comments going like, who needs E3? And I would E3 like is to
dead.
I would like to answer that once and for all. I need E3.
Yes, I think this
you would
year
prepare
has, yes, there it is, that's the hashtag for any time that E3 is at risk of being canceled. But I think this year in particular kind of showed us that without a centralized summer event, we're kind of like all cast to the wind, you know. Cool. We just kept doing
a big old summer game mess.
I mean, it's great that we were able to make our own coverage around it, but like, when we said it's the summer game, you know, summer of gaming, I don't think anybody thought that it was literally going to be like all summer long. Like Ryan Altano, he's actually, he's in a hyperbaric chamber right now recovering, because every time he thinks it's over, they say, no, Brian, there's something new that you have to cover right now. And he goes like that. And we, you know, we popped the lid off his Tupperware container. But I went to E3 in 2018. It was the first year I worked for IGN. It was the first E3 that I've ever been to. And it was amazing. It was a lifelong dream, which is why I think that it should be open to more people in the public.
I agree.
Because for it's like the gamer's, you know, ultimate dream. Oh my God, I want to go to E3. You know, I have two people on my team who have never been to E3, and they're like, this morning they're like, we're going to E3, right? And I was like, I don't get to make that call, but yes, sure. Okay. We'll try to get you there. But it's just so wonderful and so fun. And, you know, I was, after years and years of reading about it and seeing people tweet about it, I thought it was going to be more crowded and the lines were going to be longer.
Which year were you there?
2018. It was
the second year they had.
The last good one.
It was the penultimate
2017
year.
Was the first year they brought the public in, and then 2018
They fixed amazing. Some stuff in 2018. But
if 2017 was pretty messy.
If you didn't have your IGN badge, Seth, though, I think the wait times would have been
that is the secret to just being brought to the front of the line. And I always,
or any media badge. I'm not saying IGN.
If you're in the media, you're going to be you're going to be in conference rooms the entire show. You're not going to be standing in line. So
that's right.
But I mean, it needs to function for everybody, right? Like needs to be a functional event for media to do their jobs. It needs to be a functional event for executives to do their jobs. It needs to be, if you're going to make the public pay quantities of money for a ticket, then they should be getting something for that. And I think PAX has largely been a pretty successful, I mean, you know, COVID has made things more difficult, but prior to COVID, PAX was a wonderful consumer event. I love going to PAXs, and it is explicitly a consumer event. There's things for me to do there, but it is specifically for everybody to show up and play games and participate in the culture. E3, that transition was not, I don't think that was managed super well the first couple of years, and then everything just ground to a halt. So I am optimistic that the people who already make very good consumer events can at least logistically make a good consumer event out of E3 as well, without sacrificing the other important elements that make it what it is.
I love events like PAX too, and I think there is a, you know, it not every event has to be filled with announcements, you know, like E3 or the Game Awards. Like, there's something to being together with your friends and exploring stuff and playing games together. And honestly, the most popular booths at Gamescom are often for games that are already out. It's about showing your skills, and you know, like it is a little bit of a different vibe. And I will say, I'm recording this from a Wormwood game table right now. I wouldn't own this if I hadn't gone to PAX 1 year and seen all the wonderful Wormwood stuff on display. It's like it's just so much cool stuff to discover that's adjacent to gaming too, like tabletop and all that.
I always thought of PAX as it's sort of a celebration of gaming and the culture and like being with your friends. And I always thought of E3 as a celebration of games, if that distinction makes any sense to anyone else.
Yep. But
yeah. So
totally.
I'm very excited. I want some conferences. I like it when I can hear Hip Hop Gamer at a conference because I think they put a mic on him every time because he gets very excited. But if you're watching a Sony conference in the past and you hear somebody, it's almost certainly Hip Hop Gamer. So, one of the things that E3 will, I don't want to say prevent, but might stop is the constant threat of a looming Nintendo Direct. Because guess what? It's DirectWatch 2000XX. Here we go again. There was a
orange alert.
Yep.
Excuse me, what?
Yep. We are on alert for a new Nintendo Direct.
It's July. It must be time for another Nintendo Direct.
I was on vacation for the last week. Are you kidding me? We just did this.
No. We just did this, but we did a mini Direct last month.
Exactly.
Oh, that was not enough.
No. It never ends. It never ends.
But there has to be a first party showcase somewhere. Oh. Please let it be somewhere.
Oh, I'm going to lose my mind. Okay.
Yeah. Well, one of the suspicions, or I should say one of the events that caused suspicion, was that Nintendo put a bunch of its videos on private. Now, apparently there's a simple explanation for that. And that is their licensing for the music only lasts for like 1 year. And so after a year, they have to pull them down. However, why would we let the truth prevent us from speculating wildly? I mean, what is the... Well...
I mean, they also... So specifically, there were rumors already about a Direct, you know, the moment that it became clear that the next Direct was going to be a third-party Direct, already rumors started for an indie showcase and a proper first party Direct. Like it'll never go away, and like sometimes those rumors are credible and sometimes they'll just start because in the absence of something, you know, that void must be filled immediately with speculation and chatter, right?
Yes. Nintendo abhors a vacuum.
I've heard that there is a first party Direct in July as well, and I don't know if it's true.
No, stop, don't do this.
There was a thing where Sir Ken Toto, who is known for being a Nintendo knower, did a too early. And then Takashi Mochizuki, who covers it for Bloomberg, did the eyeball emoji. Cue all of the speculation.
Yes.
Everyone, listen to me. Way lies madness.
Yes.
Do not do this. It is... Look, Nintendo.
Reb, join us. We're going to Gaming Leaks and Rumors on Reddit.
You've not been a Nintendo fan long if you think this way leads to madness.
No, I think it gets worse. I think it's gotten worse in the last like 2 years.
Oh, absolutely.
Listen.
Somebody get Samus Hunter on the line.
Here's my prediction. Nintendo, at some point in the next couple of years, is going to announce some games.
Whoa.
They're going to do it.
Who is this? Where do you get your info?
I promise it's okay.
I promise.
Honestly, that's a pretty bold take by you, Reb.
Yeah.
Like, it's fine. It's totally fine. We do not need to... The reason why this bothers me so much is because people will... The rumor mill will jump... I think I've said this on this podcast before. The rumor mill will jump at literally anything, and it's circular. Yeah. So Joe Games Leaker might tweet one day and say, I have heard from reliable sources that there is a Nintendo Direct at the end of July. Like, you might just tweet this or whatever, and everyone will lose their mind. And then someone will see that, and then they will go to their little secret group chat or their Discord friend group or their little community server or whatever, and they'll be like, "Hey, I heard about
their
this."
BBS.
And then those people will hear about it from them, and then they'll go tell someone else, and then it'll go around in a circle, and eventually it'll get back to that first guy, and then that'll be a second source confirming to this person that there's now a direct. This happens constantly.
Oh, yes. I know. It's infuriating.
You don't know
I
who these sources are, and some of them are real. Like, don't get me wrong. I absolutely think some of this is like real information, but there is literally no way from our perspective that we can sift it out. So just live your life, people. It's fine.
It's the age old rumor circle that, you know, wars have started over that circular rumor where it's like, we think somebody has weapons, and like it circulates, right? Like, it happens. No, in this case, Seth was earlier referring to a video that was taken down, and that was the original Swoled video. And yeah, it is very likely that taken down because the contract for the music or the song, the actors' licenses were up, whatever. Commercials are very, very complicated. Like, IGN shot a commercial for movie theaters many, many years ago, and it's not online anywhere because of the licensing and the rights issues there. What I was going to say is, like, there was actually that sparked then rumors about the Switch Pro, right? Oh, they took down the OLED promotion because they're about to announce the Pro, which is
right. You know, which is what you do.
That's never a reason to take down an old promotion. Old trailers persist even when the sequel to something comes out, right? But it did coincide with them announcing a new version of the OLED, which is the Splatoon edition, which has fancy little, you know, custom Splatoon Joy-Con. So
looks really good, by the way.
Yeah. Oh my God, I want it. Looks so good.
I'm not going to buy it, but it looks great.
They're not
wrong. You're going to buy it.
They're not selling them separately again.
They are not. You get the
Pro. They used to do this. At least in Japan, they used to reliably sell the special edition controller separately. That's how I got my Pokemon ones originally, but anyway, that's there's a new OLED coming, but of course the Switch Pro rumors are not going to stop. They're going to
apparently some I believe it was a Chinese leaker, and they said it's a factory worker leaked that the Splatoon 3 OLED was coming out, and then it came true.
Yeah,
and then that same leaker said that there's a new hardware reveal, or actually, excuse me, a new hardware. They're going to put out a new Switch, basically, in September, is what this leaker has claimed.
Oh. Yeah. However, Switch Pro rumors have been going for more than a year at this point.
It used to be the free spot on the NVC bingo card, or as they call it in Maine, Beano.
Well, I mean, after the Swoled was released, there were all these rumors that it had intended to be a beefier console, but then Nintendo had to scale it back because of supply shortages, but that there were rumors of 4K development kits in the wild.
It's just astonishing to me and I'm guilty of this too, but we will just put reason to the side just to spread and believe and be part of the excitement of these rumors. And then, you know, we had John on who had, what was his fake site? Oh, Waddle Dee Knows. He made John
Waddle
Cartwright
Dee knows.
Made up, and what he did was Classic. He just put out 1,000 different predictions, and then after the direct, he deleted all the ones that were wrong, and everyone's like, "Oh my God, he did this 3 weeks ago." And that is the problem with almost all leakers.
I know, I love it.
We paint the target after, you know, the arrow has hit.
Yeah, but there's a difference between leakers and like journalists who are actually reporting on things. And a lot of people at like Bloomberg and such are actually well connected and have been reporting on this for some time. So there's no offense to Samus Hunters, but there is a difference.
No, and that's super true. And I do want to, I guess, addendum what I said earlier with that. Like, if somebody is writing a report, if a journalist is willing to write an article having spoken to multiple sources and verified them through their organization's, you know, editorial policies for verifying sources, and is willing to put that in print somewhere, then yeah, that's probably reliable. I still think there's some things that you still have to take with a grain of salt, right? Because the Switch Pro rumors have been reported on by like very reliable reporters for years now. And that doesn't mean they were wrong at any point. Plans change, things get delayed, things get shifted around or canceled or any number of other things. And so you got to vet what you're buying into, but you also have to take everything with a grain of salt. Even
counterpoint, believe everything you want if it is makes you happy, and then when it doesn't come true, then you just make the excuse that obviously their source had some bad information. So that's my
advice. Bad info, it just could have changed.
No, I'm just saying, believe every rumor.
I'm less excited about my uncle works at Nintendo on gaming leaks and rumors telling me that there's going to be direct on such and such. And it's like, okay, yeah, whatever. But people buy into that.
Every time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I made fun of the there was leaks that it was going to be on the 29th, and I made fun of the fact that it was on the 28th. And I said, oh, my sources, they must have had the time zones wrong. And people in my replies were like, you know, you've never worked at a big company before, you know, plans do change. Whatever, dude. All right. So.
Oh, my gosh.
Nintendo Direct Watch will be who knows where, because I'm taking vacation, and if there's a Nintendo Direct, I'll just take my vacation in LA.
When are you on vacation? What weeks?
Not next week, but the two weeks after. So starting July 18th.
The Direct will definitely be during your vacation then.
I will. I'm not going.
It'll be during Comic-Con too.
Per Schneider confirms Nintendo Direct in the next two.
That happened before. Like Per said something.
No, it's based on the Macy curse. It's not based on any insider information. I just know the moment Seth is out, they'll announce some cool stuff.
Well, here's the good news.
Yeah.
I'm not going anywhere for vacation. I'm just going to go fishing near my
house. You're tricking them.
So if there is,
I like it.
I can just jump right back into here and be like, hey, everybody, Nintendo Direct. We told you. We knew the leaks were true. So that's also, coincides perfectly with the release of Live Alive, which I believe comes out July 22nd. Now, who here among us has played Live Alive and would like to speak to it? Reb, you have your hand raised.
Oh my God, I've played so much Live Alive.
Okay.
I have to be really measured because I'm reviewing the game for IGN. And
lucky.
I have the full version and that's the original.
That's the Super Famicom.
I got the OG.
Ooh.
That's beautiful. I'm reviewing it for IGN. The preview embargo has lifted, so there's only so much I can talk about. I will say that I went on a mini vacation, like a long weekend, over this like past 6 days. I was given the code on the first day of my vacation. I thought, I'm not going to play too much of a review game while I'm on vacation. You know, I'll just dabble in a little bit. I couldn't put it down and I beat the whole thing. So
holy cow.
I'm going to try to be really measured. It's good, folks. But Live Alive is so weird. It's like, but good weird. It is quirky. Seven vignettes. I believe I can talk about four of them. That are all their own separate stories that take place in a different time period of Earth that are all in different. They all have very different mechanics. They all have a similar tying to games by the end of the fourth chapter, a seeming the same villain perhaps, or a villain that is connected between all of them so far somehow. But they're all so completely beautifully different. The Wild West chapter is like, there's a little bit of battling in it, but it is mainly about time and resource management and trying to set a bunch of working together with a bunch of villagers to set a bunch of traps before the bad guys show up. And depending on how you how well you explore and how well you set your traps, you can make what you're about to do hopefully a little bit easier.
Isn't that the plot to Seven Samurai?
It is.
It might be.
It is. It's Magnificent Seven, which is Seven Samurai adapted, is what they're doing. Yeah. And it's the music sounds like Morricone, so it's like it's all of the Westerns mixed up. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of them are very appear to be very film influenced, actually. Mm-hmm. Imperial China feels very much like a traditional like martial arts kung fu film, though. No, I can't talk about that. But you're basically
training.
It's in
the demo.
Yeah, I know. The
demo is only part of the chapter. Yeah, yeah.
Mm. I think it probably stops where the embargo tells me I can't go.
That's right.
It's all about training your successor. You have these three different individuals who this kung fu master picks up from nearby, and he's like training one of them to become his successor, and it's sort of, you know, you're investing time into each of their training differently and they're gaining different stats based on what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So that one's a lot more battle-y than the Wild West chapter is, and then there's Distant Future, which is where you're playing a little robot dude and it has no combat at all. It's basically just like sort of a puzzle exploration scenario where you're kind of trying to make friends with your crewmates and
play Square Man.
Did you catch the two major movie influences on that one?
Uh, uh, I'm making sure I can talk about this. I can't talk about the second one because I think it's very.
I played the original one, so I can tell you what is in the original. 2001 and Alien. Yeah. So the really 2001 down to kind of like the AI stuff.
I'm sorry,
and you know the chapter is set up that there's a creature in the holding cell. So like it's like each scenario definitely has these movie or classic like literature influences, which makes them really interesting. But I do think that they do a really nice job, not like just aping what came before, but creating their own stories, and then obviously mentioned this before, the way it all comes together, it's just beautiful.
It's very good at leaning into tropes exactly enough. Like can seem on the surface at the beginning a bit tropey, but the further you go, the more it breaks your expectations. I love games that make me suspicious of what the game is trying to get me to do. And Live Alive does that constantly. I have been questioning everything constantly. So Twilight of Edo Japan, which is the other one that I can talk about, the samurai one.
Yep.
At the beginning, the guy is like, hey, you can, you know, however you basically need to rescue the prisoner. Like, that's your goal. However you accomplish that is fine, you know, but he implies that you can do it through a lot of bloodshed, or you can do it stealthily because you have like a stealth move that you can use. And the first time you kill a guy in combat, like you can avoid encounters completely, but the first time you kill a guy, it starts a kill count and he starts counting how many people he's killed. And so now my Undertale brain is going haywire. And I'm like, how can I do a full pacifist run? And so I am aggressively trying to puzzle this out, but I eventually, can I talk about this? Sorry, I've got the embargo right here. Yes, I can. I eventually hit a point where I could not figure out how to get past an encounter without fighting. Like it appeared to be forcing me into a fight to proceed. And I am positive there's a way to get through that peacefully, but I don't know what it is yet. So I'm really excited to go back and replay that chapter and figure out what I'm missing. The distant future chapter too, and it was another one, because you're making coffee for these people and like trying to make them be my friend. And I'm like, what does it want me to do? What is the trick? What's the secret? Mm-hmm. What's going on? I love it when games do this. I am obsessed with Live Alive.
It's so funny because I got a Slack message at like past midnight going, oh my God, I love it. It was just, there was no context whatsoever.
Yeah, Rev texted me,
oh my God, like 3 or 4 times. And then I texted Kat.
Yes.
No, it's look, if it you have to love JRPGs, right? Like it's not, there's not no action. It's, you know, turn-based, grid-based combat. As Reb has said, the far future chapter, there's no combat at all. There's a caveman scenario where there's no language at all, right? Like each scenario is, it asks for your patience in various ways. And if you're into shooters and action games, might not be for you. But like if you're into role-playing games, it's almost like playing 7 or more different classic role-playing games. And like knowing that the person who created this went on to make Chrono Trigger should tell you that it's probably worth your attention.
Can I talk briefly about how well it does the HD 2D thing? We've had Octopath Traveler, we've had Triangle Strategy, but I think this is the best one looking one by far. Really makes use of the technology, and you can see it in the B-roll just now in the video from all of the trailers. It is a really pretty looking game. And I like that. I think a sneaky addition is the voice acting, which having characters narrating the text and everything adds to the atmosphere. I was trying out the Kung Fu adventure briefly, and I was like, I'm already in on this. The atmosphere on this is actually really excellent. So I think that seeing a proper remake of Live Alive, which this is what it is, it's a remake, is really exciting. And it's a great opportunity for people who never got to experience the original, i.e. 99% of Americans, to give it a shot.
I think it is absolutely bonkers that this got remade in a good way. Like this is a weird game. It's so...
Well, if I had to guess, I would say...
AAA games in 2022 that are 7 seemingly disparate vignettes.
Right.
Who is doing that? That is not a storytelling style that video games have embraced. We are all about the singular epic build your giant party and go fight God RPG adventure.
God is not the final boss.
Ridiculous. And but playing it, you absolutely, like I said, you can see the bones of Chrono Trigger, and you can also see how
an Octopath.
An Octopath. I think it's quite better than Octopath. The little that I've played of Octopath and what I understand of Octopath, but I think this is doing much more interesting things. But you can also see if you're an Undertale fan, or if you love like sort of that newer genre of weird like metatextual indie RPGs, Live Alive is like the inspiration for that. And oh man, it was the boss fight theme. Megalomania, I believe Toby Fox has tweeted that he based Megalovania off of Megalomania. So,
Live Alive, I thought would forever remain an oddity of a significant game that just didn't make it to the West and had almost been forgotten. I actually thought about starting a column about lost gems, like games that were forgotten for various reasons, whether they came out here or not. And like episode one was going to be Live Alive. I'm like, why? Like, given the pedigree of the people involved, I mean, manga artists who created some of Japan's most popular anime series, right? Like, they were all involved. The two, like, just ginormous stars of role-playing game creation, Square making it. It was confounding to me that it just kind of faded into obscurity. And so when it was announced, we didn't get a reaction video of me, but I was just like, what? Like, this can't be. It's like as if somebody said Sky Odyssey was coming back. I'm like, I didn't know anybody else played this game. And yeah, I think it'll be fondly remembered after this. And I think more people will talk about it. And like, if there's a multiverse and there's a version of the, of gaming where Chrono Trigger didn't come out and Live Alive came out, I think Live Alive would be taking its spot in many lists.
No way. I'm sorry, but
come on.
It has a real Kawazu vibe to it. There's a Saga Frontier kind of thing with its multiple stories going on, but you're right. It's very influential and it is really beautiful. And maybe the only reason that it didn't come out in North America was because it came out, what, 2 years before Final Fantasy made it big? Yeah.
The graphics just weren't up to the other Square games that were contemporary at the time. And that's where, Chrono Trigger obviously differs and the later Final Fantasies, the Super NES era, the games look quite a lot better. But now with this new style, I think it's better.
Yep. Yeah.
Also, music by Yoko Shimomura of Kingdom Hearts and many other fans.
One of the best.
Really good.
Yep.
Yeah. Street Fighter. Yep.
I were going to guess, my theory is that this game has been remade as a result of the Seiken Densetsu 3 remake doing well. And them releasing that in the Mana Collection as the Secret of Mana 3, which was another one of those legendary lost games that hardly anyone had played. And you could find fan translations online. But I'm hoping with this, that means we get more of those hidden gems. Like, Perry, you've mentioned Bahamut Lagoon in the past, and I think that would be a really cool one. And there's another one that I always think of and can never remember the name when it comes time to throw the chips down. So if you're out there and you know what I'm talking about, it's a role-playing game and it's by Square, so hit me in the comments on right. that one. And it never came to the United States.
Square Enix hasn't made very many of those.
No, hardly. It should be pretty easy for someone to figure out. That was our Live Alive discussion. Reb, thank you. I'm so excited. By the way, there's a demo on the eShop right now, and you can download it, play three chapters, and not to their finish, your progress will carry over to the final game, which comes out July 22nd, which I pre-ordered, obviously, on a physical version. Real quick, Monster Hunter Sunbreak is out. Who here has played it? I know who played it. Kat.
I fired it up yesterday. Finally had a moment to play some Sunbreak, beat the first monster in high rank. It was the Daimyo Hermit Crab, which is shoots a stream of water at you. It has claws, very slow, very sluggish, relatively easy to solo. And I had really intense end game gear, so it wasn't hard to beat or anything. But now I'm in that wonderful moment in any Monster Hunter game, which is I've hit the master rank, which means that all of that end game gear that I grinded so hard to get is now worthless. And I get to go and get a whole new set of end game gear. It's going to be so much fun. But I went into an entirely new area. It's a new camp, which is something that they usually do with these expansion. It's called Elgato, which is an interesting choice for the name. I'm already seeing new mechanics like Ruby wire bugs. I don't really know what that's all about, but they added quite, they always add so much to these actual adventures. It's interesting. The reviews were maybe a little bit lukewarm. I've seen some folks say that it doesn't add as much as, say, Iceborne. I'm playing on Nintendo Switch, and there's a part of me that wishes that I were playing on PC instead, because I think the 60 FPS makes an absolutely huge, huge, huge difference with Monster Hunter. I've been playing Iceborne quite a bit in the lead up to Sunbreak. So when I got into Sunbreak, I was like, how do I play this game again? Because the mechanics are all different. You have wire bugs in this one, which has you basically leaping into the air like with a pulley or whatever you would call it. And I'm using the Switch axe. And the Switch and every single weapon in Monster Hunter is wildly different from the other weapons. So I'm using the Greatsword in Iceborne, which has a different cadence, different combos, different moves. And the Switch axe just has its own set of mechanics. So I'm like, how? Okay, yes, I think I remember how I'm supposed to do this. Luckily, I watched the Summer Games Done Quick Monster Hunter Rise speedrun where they were also using the Switch axe. And so I was like, okay, I remember how to do this. So while I was fighting the hermit crab daimyo thing, I was slowly but surely remembering the actual mechanics of how to play this thing. And now I think I'm good. I remembered that I had an Amaterasu skin for my my pup. And I was like, okay, I'm back. I'm back in on Sunbreak. So more to come, I'm sure, because my group will be reuniting starting next week to start grinding through Sunbreak. But I see a lot of people saying, I don't know, it's just more Monster Hunter. But I'm like, yes, it's more Monster Hunter.
Right.
Monster Hunter, Master Rank, let's go. This is the real game right here.
Well, that brings me to the question that I wanted to pose to the panel is, with a expansion like this, is it enough to get you to return to a game that you might have lapsed? Or is it enough even to make you pick up a game that you never played? Or is it just too little, too late? Reb, I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
Oh, no, Monster Hunter's not for me. I am extremely happy.
Well, in general, an expansion of this sort of caliber, would it?
Oh, you were playing a lot of Animal Crossing. Game?
Yeah,
oh, sure,
okay.
Yeah. I mean, if the equivalent of this was put into Animal Crossing or like another game that I play semi, I mean, I'm the kind of
Breath of the Wild.
Yeah, I'm the kind of person who if I love a game and someone hands me a big chunk of DLC or an expansion, I even if I've stopped playing that game for the last 6 months to a year, I will absolutely go back to it for that thing.
Oh, like, wow.
I'm gonna do it whenever the inevitable Elden Ring DLC gets announced. You bet I'm gonna be there first day. But yeah, I'm not a Monster Hunter person. I'm happy for the Monster Hunter people.
Happy for
the Monster Hunter
Hunters.
People I know just want more Monster Hunter, and this sounds like that. So congratulations, all of you. I'm
exactly.
Happy for you.
I heard it has more hunting and more monsters.
And more gear. That's the important thing. So that you can keep advancing. I think the thing that I struggle with whenever these DLCs come out like a year after the original release, I'll put like 100 hours into the game and I'll be like, I love this game. And then when I come back X months later, I go, okay, so I've got all this gear and I've got all these items and there are all these mechanics I remember. I don't remember at all how to play this game. So there's always that adjustment period as I slowly learn how to do it. But then they also put in a lot of new mechanics as well. Quality of life improvements, enhancements to the actual gear and the combat. The balance of the combat usually ends up changing as they kind of rejigger everything. And so it's almost like learning an entirely new game all over again, which can be maybe a little bit exhausting, but I'll get over it with Sunbreak. The main reason that I'm excited to go back to it is I have a group of friends that I like to play with. It's my main multiplayer game. And I know that's going to be the case for a lot of people.
Yeah, I remember when the Champions Ballad DLC came out for Breath of the Wild and I hadn't played it in like seven, 8 months or something. And I think one of the first things Champion Ballad asks you to do is this trial where you can't get hit. Like if you get hit, you're dead. And I, having not played that game for 7, 8 months, that was not a fun time. So game makers, if you're out there and you're throwing big expansions out there, give people something to ease them back in, maybe. If you can.
You mean like kind of like an MMO where you have a content drop that leads up to the actual expansion.
Yeah,
so like a major
content.
Patch or something. Mm. Yeah, because they'll often do that in like Final Fantasy 14 and WoW, right? Where they'll have the preparation
absolutely.
Events and that kind of thing. Yeah, you should do that in Monster Hunter. But Tom Marks reviewed it for IGN.com and said that it's actually a relatively simple expansion. It's still a whole lot of fun, but not nearly as substantial or surprising as Iceborne, lacking fresh ideas beyond clever AI followers that are restricted to single player hunts. It abandoned the Rampage quests. Thank God. I didn't like the Rampage quests. So if you played the original, the Rampage quests were actually quite boring. They were a little bit of a tower defense situation where tons of monsters were coming at you, maybe like a horde mode, that kind of thing. And you're just trying to hold on until you got to the final apex monster, and then you would actually fight that one. It felt a little too far removed from the actual Monster Hunter experience. And I kind of like the idea of a horde mode or just a succession of boss rushes for Monster Hunter, but I don't think it was carried off very well. And it was a big part of the grinding because all of the Rampage weapons in Monster Hunter Rise were some of the best weapons. So I'm really glad that they're gone, actually. Sorry, Tom. Mm-hmm.
You know who I think does DLC great is the Borderlands series. And I know they're not quite as gigantic as is sort of these Monster Hunter add-ons, but they have a great cadence to them. And sometimes they're self-contained. And in the case of Borderlands 3, some of the DLC was better than Borderlands 3, I thought. So, and you get
the same with Pokemon, right?
Exciting.
Sword and Shield's DLC was way better than the original Pokemon Sword and Shield. Yeah, huge improvement. I think that I prefer maybe more of a cadence, I think, to the actual content releases rather than a mega drop.
Yeah,
that comes a year later. After
that's what I like about
Silence.
It, you know, when they announce a Borderlands, you're like, okay, in 3 months we're going to get a DLC, and then like, you know, 2 months after that we'll get another one and another one until it all rounds it out, and we have this big wholesome package of guns and.
But I think if you haven't played Monster Hunter Rise yet, this is kind of a great time to get into it because, I mean, this is the real end game. Right here. Like one of the problems with Monster Hunter Rise is that, you know, you were just playing in high rank and there was plenty to do and there was a fun monster to fight at the end that if I recall correctly was shooting laser beams, things like that.
Cool.
And it was a real technical accomplishment on the Nintendo Switch. Capcom, low-key, one of the best tech business.
I still think Rise is the best looking Switch game, and somebody in the comments agreed with me. So that means
But if you missed it the first time, now's the time to pick it up because this is it right here. This is all the Monster Hunter. So you're going to get like a solid 120, 130 hours of content.
I was going to say, you have to have a second life though, because that's a lot of gameplay.
Hey, Prime Day is next week. It could be on sale for all I know.
Put away Destiny. Pick up Monster Hunter.
There you go.
Multiplayer game.
I'm going to bring it back to Square Enix. And we're going to talk a little bit about Final Fantasy Crisis Core, which is extremely popular with at least with the IGN Deals audience. I know that like people cannot get enough and are just pre-ordering it left and right. The Switch version, however, this is no surprise. It's going to see its resolution and FPS affected versus the PS5 and Xbox and PC.
Well, at least we're not getting the PSP port.
That is true.
Look, we could have gotten a Persona 3 portable, which is kind of what ended up happening in the Persona 3 collection. But, you know, there's actually been a lot of discourse recently about quote-unquote impossible ports for a Nintendo Switch. Mm-hmm. Maybe not happening. Maybe the Nintendo Switch is just lagging further and further behind other releases now that the PS5 and the Xbox Series X are fully entrenched and everything. I think that... We'll see how the Nintendo Switch version of this game ends up coming out. I asked them what the lead platform they were developing for was, because one of the things with Sonic Frontiers is that I believe they're actually leading with the Switch with their actual development, because they want it to work for Japanese audiences. They want it to work for the Switch the best. Mm-hmm. So they don't want that version to be compromised. But as a result, game doesn't look so great on other platforms. Yeah. Crisis Core is leading, I think, on PC. Maybe because they're shooting for 120 FPS on PC, according to the new interview that I did.
So many FPSs.
Yeah, and they're shooting for 60 on the PS5, Xbox Series X. So I think we can, as usual, expect, you know, 30 FPS on the Nintendo Switch and everything. Katase was saying yes, it's going to be a similar experience across the board, no matter what platform you're playing on. We'll see. I think Square generally has a pretty good tech track record on the Nintendo Switch. Correct me if I'm wrong. Well, yeah. Please yell at me in the comments or something. But
No, look, Japanese developers face the reality that the Switch is by far the most popular platform in their native country, right? And so they definitely want to do
it. Every country.
That's what you see with, like, you know, Dragon Quest on Switch. So you certainly see it with Monster Hunter on Switch. So hopefully this will be decent.
Yeah, but also, look, this is a big generalization, but I think it's a safe one. The vast majority of people who purchased a Nintendo Switch did not do so because they thought it would be graphically superior to everything
right.
else.
Yeah, I think you're
They purchased
probably,
it because
right.
it they liked the sort of gimmick of the portable console thing, or they like Nintendo, or any other, or there was a specific game, an exclusive game that they wanted, or any other combination of factors. No
that
one
game
is
was Animal Crossing.
Crisis Core and thinking no. The Nintendo Switch is going to be the most graphically impressive place to play this, or I'm out. I'm not playing Crisis. No one's thinking about that. The people who are playing Crisis Core on Switch are people who are already bought into the Switch and don't care, as long as it's like fairly functional, right? I mean, it still needs to run okay.
But there have also been versions of ports that just have not been good.
No, and that's fair.
Years. Even like old PS2 games, like the SMT3 Nocturne collection on Nintendo Switch, not great.
That's
like consistently
fair.
Very buggy, technical glitches, just across the board, like, so
right. Well, that's not what we're talking about here. I mean, basically anytime there's sort of a news that's like, oh, the FPS on the Switch is going to be lower on this than it is on other Xbox Series X.
There's games that are 60 FPS on Nintendo Switch.
Well, it's
a thing that happened, and I think people are maybe there are at least a handful of people who are more interested in frame rate than they are fidelity. And
I am one of those people.
Yeah. Isn't Neon White 60 FPS? That game's gorgeous.
It is,
you know?
Yeah.
I just think that you automatically know going in, if the Switch is your primary console, that you are making some level of compromise and you have resigned yourself to that, or you own a PS5 and Xbox Series.
That was what I was going
to
say.
And are going to play it over there because that's something you care
I
about.
I would imagine that anyone who's like really excited about Final Fantasy Crisis Core is probably going to play it on their PS5 or their Xbox anyway. So,
joke's on you. I'm playing on my Switch. I want to play
it
portable.
Well,
but that's exactly it. Or they want to play it portable. And so they
actually, I have a Steam Deck sitting over here. I'll play it on that.
Okay, well.
Oh, man, you just lost a sale.
Oh.
Switch.
As for Crisis Core itself, I think it's interesting that they're connecting it so heavily to Final Fantasy VII Remake, but they're at pains to say that it's not a remake, it's a remaster. And when they say that it's a remaster, quote unquote, what they mean is they're not completely changing the story like they did with Final Fantasy VII Remake. So they're not going to have any new story elements, according to them. They're going to kind of play it straight, but they're kind of using it as a direct lead-in to Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, which is part two of the remake games. And I kind of am expecting a teaser trailer of some sort after the post-credits. What a post-credits reveal for Final Fantasy Rebirth to get people going in the best Kingdom Hearts fashion. So
yeah,
look forward to that.
Set your cat expectations accordingly. So
wow,
yeah.
Set your cat expectations to kill. Let's go
in the cat cave. Now we need to talk about something that's near and dear to all of our hearts, and that is the GameCube and why we love it. And this week, it's the spice orange. That's why the spice must flow. It's the most orange of all the consoles, and intentionally so, not just because it was in a house with smokers or it was left out in UV radiation. But yeah, originally it was purple. That was just the base default color. Here's a purple
and black
console and black. Yes. And who's laughing now? What were the four original colors were spice orange, black, silver, and
the purple lunchbox. But people were kind of goofing on it because multicolored consoles were not a thing, really. You were black. You had a black console because you were sleek.
Yeah.
Or big and boxy like the Xbox. And Nintendo had the temerity to release a console in the color purple, which was vaguely feminine and people could not believe it. And she's like, oh my God, you got some girliness on my console.
I always thought it was papal. It was, you know, it was the most religious of consoles because it was the same color as the Pope's socks.
What?
Yeah, the color of the Pope was purple.
What? Wow. I mean, it's like royalty, right?
Catholic facts I somehow don't know.
Yeah, that's right. Kidding. That's right.
You didn't know the Pope wears purple socks?
I didn't know that, no.
It is interesting.
Never heard
it
that expression. Interesting.
So I remember when Nintendo went with the kind of multicolor approach. It was obviously the N64 already had the multi-controller colors, right? And it was easier to keep your controllers apart from who's player one, who's player two. It actually served a function there. And then Apple ran with, if you guys remember, the iMac.
Are you kidding me? I love the iMac.
Apple turned its PC, its Macs, monitors, all sorts of colors of toothpaste and
flavors. They were flavors of candy.
That's right. And I think when Nintendo announced the kind of multicolor approach, we credited Apple with breaking the ice there.
Everything was translucent multicolor back then. I remember having an iron that was like translucent.
And then obviously, Nintendo did it with the N64. You got the see-through colors and you got the multicolor approach. But nobody expected a new console to launch with an aggressive color. Everybody thought consoles were supposed to be heard, not seen, right? They needed to blend in with your credenza and your setup and all of that. And
fancy DVD player.
Exactly.
I mean, God forbid people figure out that you're actually playing video games circa 2001. But isn't it interesting that Nintendo spent at least a decade chasing the aesthetic of Apple from the iMac
everything,
all the way to the Wii with the controller and the white console and how sleek it was. It looked like an iPod or an iPhone circa that time. Nintendo really wanted to kind of capture that look and feel.
Yep. No,
bring
for sure.
Bring back translucent hardware.
Bring back the
blue and the purple see-through stuff.
Yes, I agree.
Know. What happened? Why is it not cool anymore? I have custom Joy-Con that are the
it'll be back. Purple,
but those were the coolest N64 controllers. Those were the coolest Game Boys to have when I was in school. If you had those, color, you were the cool person.
Yep. You know, maybe
I don't know. We should make that cool again.
You know, maybe electronics just aren't interesting enough anymore. They used to have these complicated, gears and steam engines and things inside. So it was cool to have translucent plastic and see in.
You now see
it's
the coal
just green
inside.
Chips.
Yeah.
I don't care.
I think that,
show me the guts.
PlayStation, Sony did an admirable effort trying to make the PlayStation 5 stand out from the rest of your consumer electronics, but I think that is just the ugliest.
It still looks like a humidifier.
It looks like terrible. A base star from Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah,
I want to like it. It looks like a building from SimCity 2000. It's I want to like it, but every time I see it, it's like it also wobbles. I don't know. Is it me or is it them? But like,
When you put it on its side, if you try to push a button, it slides off the thing that it's supposed to. Yeah.
I remember when the PS3 came out, I thought this thing is huge and ugly. And then the PS5 came out. It was like the Super Star Destroyer casting the shadow over the Star Destroyer and Empire Strikes Back. That was the PS5.
Yeah, and then the Xbox looks kind of like Deep Thought from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, right? Like it's this supercomputer box that's very, very square and pensive looking with its eye there.
You're talking about 2001 earlier, and there it is. Like, there's the obelisk.
There's a Steam Deck, which is a humongous Game Gear.
What you worked about as well as one, too. Because it has that big black circle on the front, I put a pair of googly eyes at the top, so it looks like my Series S is just going...
It's like... That's awesome.
It's great.
But taking it back to the GameCube, the color wasn't what bothered me back when it released. It was that it was very, very tall, and it was a top loader, and it ignored the fact that since the days of the NES and Super NES, when we all, we sat on the floor in our carpet and the console was right there with its short controller cables, what had happened since then is that the machines had become consumer electronics and they moved into the TV stands and the credenzas and all of that. And they usually had room for a device this tall, like a receiver or a DVD player, and they were all front loading and had the buttons on the front. And so suddenly, if you put your GameCube in there and you hit the eject button, it's like, bang, the lid would hit the roof of whatever TV stand you had. And that bugged me. But then I realized, why? Just pull it out for a second and put the disc in.
I mean, it has a handle. It has an easy handle.
It has a handle.
You can take it with you.
Yep.
Strap those it to, disc trays strap it to could, your belt.
Those style. Disc trays could be a problem, though, right?
Yeah.
That's what I remember.
Yes.
They are.
That's just a fail point when you have a disc that ejects the... Anyway.
Lots of people never learned that you can press on the center and the disc comes out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that is something that a lot of people don't know, and they just yank right on it. But
yeah, they yank it out.
There it is. That's weird.
20 years later, everybody wants colored consoles, custom Xbox Series X's are all the rage. And we just got those absolutely beautiful Splatoon 3 Switch OLED, which I want so very, very much.
I'll go a step further. I want more stupid looking consoles. As long as they fit in the, fitting in the entertainment center is important. But as long
as
they
have the play date?
I don't. I wish I did.
I got it right here.
Yeah, I want more consoles that look ridiculous. Bright orange, funny little shapes.
Put a crank on it.
The PS5 looks absurd. It looks like a home appliance that someone bought on a discount at Sears, and it's great. And I think we should have more of them.
Well, I disagree. I think it's horrible. But I do think that we should have more weird looking things. I think all of those
is if it were spice orange.
My favorite part of any console cycle, I'm sure I've said this before, is like when we're speculating and they're making artist renditions of what, you know, the next Xbox is going to be like. And somebody's like, it's going to look like an X, or they just make the stupidest looking, you know, like that Nintendo NX leak that was
the football,
the football controller that everyone
controllers. The sticks are in the middle of the screen.
Yeah. Like everyone's like, well,
I can't see my character.
Yeah, that's why make all those ridiculous artists' conceptions that leading up to a console's release. Make those real. Sony, right. Give us the boomerang PS3.
Oh my god,
that horrible that scam that fooled everybody. Going back to leaks, but we are rapidly running out of time, so I want to quickly get to what we have been playing. Reb, what, in addition to Live Alive, have you been playing that you could talk about?
I have been playing a little game called Freshly Frosted. I've actually been playing it on the Xbox, but it is also out on Switch. It is a puzzle game that takes place in a mental donut factory of sorts. You are imagining a factory that makes donuts, and your goal There's a little thing that ejects plain donuts, and then there's a little receiver somewhere else in these square top-down levels, and your goal is to build conveyor belts that will take the donuts from one end to the other. But on the way, there are different pieces of machinery that will put frosting and sprinkles and whipped cream and cherries on them in that order. Ooh. And every level calls for a certain amount of these things to be built. And so you have to build conveyor belts that correctly pass the decorating stations and get the donuts to the other end. And as you can imagine, this is iterated on repeatedly with different, sometimes you'll have levels that call for multiple kinds of donuts, or maybe you'll have a bunch of stations that put cherries on top, but you actually don't want cherries on top. And so you have to sort of skirt around them. And the amount of puzzles and deviations on this concept is very impressive. The music is very soothing. It's like listening to a Headspace meditation. It's a very, very pleasant little game. And I'm enjoying the very satisfying rhythm of when you get your factory going, all the donut things, they move and they decorate to the beat. So it's just this nice little rhythmic. It's very satisfying and nice to look at. Freshly Frosted, very good.
I'm into it. I'm going to have to check this one out. Per, what have you been playing?
Well, you know, after we talked about the repacked game coming to Pac-Man, you know, we kindly got some codes from Namco to play Pac-Man Museum Plus, which I was ignoring because I already have... I obviously have access to it on Game Pass, but like playing it on Switch is really fun because it is a great mobile game collection. It has Pac-Man, Super Pac-Man, Pac-N-Pal, Pac-Land, Pac-Mania, Pac-Attack, Pac-N-Time, a whole bunch of, what is it, like a dozen Pac-Man games, Seth, I think?
Yeah, there's a lot. I was playing this also, and I was actually really surprised to see Pac-Man 256.
256 is in there, that's right.
And that was
Super Pac-Man. You know, I have the arcade machine in my house and love it dearly. There's some weird ones, right? Like his 2D excursions, which are not quite as successful. But the core Pac-Man maze games are just really, really good.
Puzzle game too.
If you're into gaming history, Pack Attack's in it too. If you're into gaming history, Pack in Time, extremely weird game where you grapple hook yourself to to the points and all of that. We mentioned that Pac-Man has been just really inventive, kind of like Mario when it comes to branching out into different gameplay styles, and that more of those games than with many other characters are actually successful. So, yeah, I'm digging it. I like it. I think it's a really good on-the-go game to play.
Yeah, and there are some pack versions in there that I was completely, wholly unaware of. And it also has Championship Edition, which is...
is one of the best games ever made. Come on.
DX is the best. Good.
I think you made half of those Pac-Man games up.
No, they're real. They are real.
It has Pac-Man Arrangement Arcade version.
Made didn't up. Even know what that was. Yep, yeah.
Totally made. I did not make that one
up. It's a real thing. Made up.
Pac-Time is dumb, and I don't like that one at all. But, Kat, what have you been playing?
Pac-Man Battle Royale, which is this arcade machine I would love in my house, but
before PUBG, there are Pac-Man Battle
Royale. So expensive. Yeah. So if anybody ever wants to give me a nice birthday present, a Battle Royale machine.
Right. Kat, have you been playing anything other than Monster Hunter?
Well, I rolled credits on Act 2 of Dragon Quest XI and did a podcast about it. I'm into Act 3 now, in which there's a big twist, and I'm not going to reveal it. But cat take, I think Dragon Quest XI is the best RPG on Switch right now.
Whoa!
It's an amazing game. So stately, so gorgeous.
I need to get back
characters
into
are so
it.
Wonderful. Love the battle system. It's just a culmination of everything that made Dragon Quest great. So if you haven't played Dragon Quest XI, definitely go check it out. The Switch version is one of the best ones.
By the way, you Kat, you turned me on to Neon White, which I don't think we were on a podcast together. That was a really good recommendation. That game's awesome. Really loving it.
And people are really into Neon White. The speedrunning community has definitely really embraced Neon White hardcore. I think there's a low key. I think Neon White community is really blowing up, and we're going to be talking about that game quite a bit for the rest of the year. But I'm also, you may recall that my Nuzlocke run ended in failure. In Pokemon Crystal, I lost to Morty because I was really stupid. But I'm doing a revenge run this weekend on a stream. Rep's going to be there, so come check it out.
That sounds like the first
what any of those words meant just now.
You don't have to.
Those were made up Pac-Man.
Those were, yes. Those are all.
I would love to explain Nuzlocke to you, Pear, but I think Seth is going to tell me we don't have time for that.
Okay.
Come join us and find out afterwards.
Yeah, you'll have to find out this weekend. I was just going to say real quick, I played the Live Alive demo. I loved it. I played the Pac-Man Museum. I loved that as well. But I also played some of those Sega Genesis games. Famously, I played Zero Wing. They set us up the bomb.
Yeah.
That game, outside of the memes, it's not a bad shmup. And it's actually, I really like the opening sequence. And if I had seen that as a kid, it would have just been probably my favorite game. Because any taste of Japanese pop culture, whether it's like just a piece of art in a game, was all I wanted in life. And it was so hard to get back then. But yeah, that Zero Wing.
Did you play Comic Zone?
I have played Comic Zone in the past. Right. Yes, but I didn't.
It's a very hard game.
It's just it's just such a creative art style to use. You know, like jumping from comic panel to the next. The
most '90s game too. So '90s. Yeah.
We had, the Nintendo Online's been a little tepid with the additions. Like, it's cool we got Pokemon Snap, but we got a sequel to Pokemon Snap before that, right? And so we weren't really starved for that. But they did, they recently had released, a couple of treasure games for Genesis. Mm-hmm. And now these four games, keep those coming and leave the Jaluco ones in the shoebox for now.
I was going to say the Sega Genesis online offerings are the absolute jewel in the Nintendo Online crown, because those are consistently the best and most interesting games on the system, not including, the expansion and the original. So if you don't have the expansion yet, there are some banger Sega Genesis games on there. But that's all I can talk about because we are out of time. We have one question block from Kate Adkins. Kate asks, why Nintendo? I think that's a great question. Why Nintendo indeed? So that is all the time we have for this week's NVC. Follow us on Twitter at NVC Podcast. Submit your question block questions on the NVC Facebook group so I can summarily ignore them at the end of the show. I want to thank Red on the ones and twos. I want to thank Reb for coming out and talking about Live Alive with us. And most of all, I want to thank you, the listener / viewer, for hanging out. And remember, NVC is the only place where you can
get the thing.
Get the thing.
Get alive, alive.
Get the thing.
Also, bring back Dead Alive, since we're bringing back things that ended with alive.
Hey there, it's Rachel Ballinger, and I am extremely excited to invite you to Rachel Uncensored. It's my podcast where I sit down and get real with my friends and celebrity guests, where we talk about all sorts of topics, and sometimes we might be under the influence when we do so. We cover things from personal stories to hot button issues, and it's the only place on the internet you can find an uncensored version of me. It's a side of me that you might not have seen before because it's not the most family or brand friendly. But don't worry, I'm still sort of slightly a decent human being. If you're intrigued, then make sure you check it out. New episodes drop every Wednesday. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss out on the fun and candid conversations we have here on Rachel Uncensored.